The following is intended solely for the use of those with a sense of adventure.
I'm shaking the dust of this town off my feet, and I'm going to see the world.
This is Travel with Hawkeye. Here's your host, Mark Hawkeye Lewis.
Welcome to Episode 9. Thank you for joining us. Our special guest on today's episode, Emmy Award-winning actor Hector Elizondo. He's currently in the ABC series Last Man Standing. I'm going to talk to him a little about travel and his life, as we like to do from time to time. Also visiting us today on our podcast, Tish Auctionrider. She is a writer, and she's written a brand new book called At Home in the World, Reflections on Belonging While Wandering the Globe. And I love to bring travel writers on the show and just get their perspective on the world. But she did something that a lot of us would love to do. She just, her and her husband just quit their jobs and traveled around the world for 9 months. But here's the difference, the caveat that a lot of us would never imagine doing. She has three kids. She's a mom of three young kids too. And she traveled the world and homeschooled them while they, you know, just globetrotted. And that is something I don't know if I would want to do. And we're going to talk to her about that. And she said it was a great experience. We talked about that. That's what her book basically is about, is what it was like to travel the world with her three young kids. And you know what? After talking to her, maybe you'll change your mind and maybe something you want to do, or maybe not. I also want to just point out at the beginning of the podcast, because I usually share this at the end of the podcast, and I know when people get through the guests and they see there's like 30 seconds left, a lot of people just turn off the podcast. I want to pass along our social media connections. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. We're on Facebook, at Hawkeye On Air. That's my connection there. When I go travel sometimes, I like to post a lot of stuff on Instagram stories, so I encourage people to follow me on Instagram. Also, if you go to our website, travelwithhawkeye.net, you'll find a connection there for books. And I've written two books, and I kind of want to plug my books. My new one is San Antonio Uncovered. It's a travel guide to San Antonio, which is my adopted hometown. I'm a military kid, and it's kind of where my parents dropped me off. So that became my adopted hometown, though I live in Dallas now. And also, I have a novel out called The Travis Club, which is set in San Antonio. The reason I bring those two up is because if you get the book San Antonio Uncovered, there's a chapter in there about a building called the Tower Life Building. And for many years, it was the tallest building in San Antonio. And also, the claim to fame was it was the tallest building west of the Mississippi. I will say, though, that as I've traveled along around the country and visited many other cities west of the Mississippi, seems like a lot of cities claim that their building was once the tallest building west of the Mississippi. I've never seen any official record of the tallest building west of the Mississippi, and you'd have to have a history of it going back for a long time. So I think it's more of a bit of civic pride. But regardless, the Tower Life Building is interesting. The fact that there used to be an observation deck on the top of the Tower Life Building. And if you're familiar with this show, you know I love observation decks. And I actually got to work in that building a long time ago, and we had access to the observation deck. When I said access, what I really mean is there was a bathroom on the top floor, and if you opened the window in the men's room, you could climb on top of the toilet, climb out the window, and illegally get onto the observation deck. And they had thick walls and everything, so it was very, very safe once you got out there, and it was just kind of ironic that you had to climb through the bathroom window to get the observation deck. But nevertheless, it had been closed for many years when San Antonio built the Tower of the Americas during the World's Fair in 1968. But this building, the Tower Life Building, was built during the 20s, during the Depression. And it's just an amazing building if you're a fan of architecture. But one thing that I noticed, and there's a point to all this, is that they had gargoyles on this building. And since then, I have been fascinated by gargoyles and done some research about them. And the history of the gargoyle is very different than I imagined it, because I was told at the beginning that gargoyles were to ward off evil spirits from a building. Okay, I can get maybe a building that was, you know, built in medieval times to have gargoyles, but this is a building in San Antonio in the United States that was built in the 20s. It didn't seem like people back then were worried so much about gargoyles. It seemed more to be an architectural feature that was added, and that's what I kind of thought. So I went and did some research on gargoyles, and you find them a lot in churches in Europe. And there, I would believe, they were to ward off evil spirits. But even that is really not correct. Actually, they were more to kind of depict the evil that was outside the church. And when you saw a gargoyle, and if you came inside the church, you got away from the evil, the gargoyles, which depicted that, and you would find the goodness of the Lord inside the church. But actually, the gargoyle had a much more practical application than just a, you know, an analogy for evil outside the church. The word gargoyle actually comes from the French word of throat or to gargle. And actually, if you ever go to Europe and you get a chance to take a rooftop tour of a church, which a lot of churches do this now, they allow you to go on top of the churches. I did it in Barcelona in the cathedral there, and Notre Dame in Paris also allows you to go on the roof. Sometimes it's easy to get up there. Sometimes you got to wait in line, and it just depends from church to church. But if you ever get a chance to do this, you can go and verify this. And this is actually very well known now in architectural circles, so it's not anything new that I'm bringing to the church, but I'm bringing to a lot of travelers who think that the gargoyles were this there to ward off evil spirits. But actually, the gargoyles were there to divert water from the roof and away from the side of the building. Because back when they built a lot of these churches in Europe, the mortar that they used was not as strong as mortars we use today. It was rather primitive, and water would deteriorate the mortar quickly. So they had to come up with a device that would take rainwater, and instead of just going over the side of a building, it would divert it away from the building. And so if you were to get on top of the roof, you could see that the gargoyles actually had a channel, and the water would go through sometimes through the flying buttresses of the church, and there'd be aqueducts on the roof that would divert the water into the gargoyles, and then it would go through the mouth of the gargoyle, and it would be separated from the wall by about a foot and a half, and thus the rainwater would not go down the walls and ruin the mortar. And that is the reason they have gargoyles on churches, and of course, as an analogy of the evil that is outside the church, but really, it's just to keep the rainwater from deteriorating the mortar on these medieval buildings. So next time you actually are in Europe or you see a gargoyle on a building, you can pass that along. All right, so that's the history of the gargoyle. We got Tish Auctionwriter with us. She's one of my favorite travel writers. She's written a brand new book called At Home in the World, Reflections of Belonging While Wandering the Globe. And last time I talked to you, you were living in Bend, Oregon. Now you're living in Austin. And somewhere in between there, you sold everything and traveled the world with your children. Do I have that timeline correct?
That is correct, yeah. We left Bend, traveled, and then moved back to Austin, which was a spoiler alert to us. Like, we didn't even know that was going to happen. We thought we were moving back to Bend, so yeah.
Okay, well, let's talk about, first of all, let's talk about the years that you traveled. And so you and your husband decided to sell everything, and well, not almost everything, but some things in storage, and travel the world. But there's a little caveat to this story, is it not? It wasn't just you and your husband.
Right. We also brought our three kids with us because, you know, being gone for that long, we figured we should take them.
So you were gone for a whole year, and then you wrote about your experiences of traveling for a year. Was it just 1 year, or was it a little bit longer than that?
It was a year. Actually, it was a little less than a year. It was a school year, and so we brought our three kids, ages 9, 6, and 4, at the time when we left, yeah.
Okay, and then you wrote a book called At Home in the World, Reflections on Belonging While Wandering the Globe. So you and your husband decided to not only travel the world, but also homeschool your two oldest kids, or maybe all three kids, since one's at four, while traveling the world. And so now we have a book about these experiences, and it's quite an amazing story because, I mean, a lot of people imagine what it would be like to just travel for a whole year. But when you bring your kids with you, it's a totally different type of experience, is it not?
Right. And, you know, we tell people all the time that this wasn't a vacation for sure. Not only did we have our kids with us, because I think when we have kids, it changes the whole MO of the type of travel we do, but we worked the whole time. We brought our work with us and we called it world schooling the kids. And we just put everything we needed in each of our backpacks for a whole year and wandered around. That's right.
Okay. So can I ask what you and your husband do that you were able to work while you were traveling like this?
Yeah, well, my job is a writer. I'm a full-time writer, so I can take that from anywhere. And then my husband worked at the time for a nonprofit organization doing just operations and running things basically remotely from his computer. And so he asked, and they gave him, you know, a special okay to just take his work with him because he could have done it remotely.
Okay, so we decided to travel the world. And now, did you start in Bend? Is that where you started? And then you flew off to where?
Yeah, more or less. We did come back to Austin for a few days just to say hi to the family here. And then we first went to Beijing. So we went westbound. We started in China and spent time there and then slowly made our way around back to London and then back to Austin.
Okay. And in between there, we stopped in Hong Kong, Thailand, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand, Sri Lanka, Uganda, Ethiopia, Zimbabwe, Kenya, Morocco, France, Italy, Croatia, Kosovo, Turkey, Germany, and England. Did I hit them all?
Actually, those are the ones I wrote about. We actually we went to 30 of them, but which sounds a little more impressive than it is, because Europe, you know, being Europe, a lot of those countries are small. But we count every country that we at least got out in and spent time in, and so that would be 30 countries. Yep.
Yeah, I had lunch in Liechtenstein one time, and I count that as a country
exactly.
I visited.
Exactly. We had coffee in Bosnia for about half an hour, and we count that too.
Okay. So Right. Fair enough. And so the theme kind of your book is why taking your kids on an adventure, as you call it, might be the best thing you ever do. Explain that.
Well, you know, I'm a big believer in the way we all learn best is through storytelling, by hands-on experience. And so what better way to do that than actually use the world, the actual world, as our biggest, greatest textbook? And so, you know, we thought, well, while the kids are still young enough to be really adaptable, flexible, and impressionable, yet old enough to carry their own backpacks and not need diaper changes, let's take them with us. Let's, you know, especially while we can still work from anywhere, we didn't know how long our jobs would allow that. And let's just use where we were as what we were learning. And so as far as schooling goes, we concentrated our efforts on reading, writing, and math. And then everywhere else, we just used as like history. Okay, we're going to the Great Wall of China today. Let's learn about that. Okay, biology. We're going to go snorkel the Great Barrier Reef. Let's learn about that. And we just used wherever we were as what we learned. And honestly, I mean, those of us in more traditional schools growing up, the way we learned best was, you know, on those field trips, doing the science experiments, you know, the hands-on learning. So that's pretty much how we thought of it for a year, like one giant field trip.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure your kids probably know more about the Great Barrier Reef at their age than I do, because they were there, they saw it firsthand, and what a great way to learn. Now, you sound like super parents and everything, but I know what parenting is like. I mean, it's not all just you know, every one great moment after another. There's a whole bunch of things that go along with parenting, and when you're traveling the world, it kind of compounds that. Can you kind of tell us some of the frustrations, or, you know, I don't want to paint just the rosiest picture of all and everybody's headed out with their kids. I'm sure there are some times you're thinking, what are we doing?
Yeah, you know, I say that the best part of the trip is all the family bonding, but the flip side of that same coin, the worst part was all the family togetherness. Like, we were together 24/7. I think my husband and I had 3 dates the whole time we were gone. And, you know, it became a test of our mettle, just because so many times we were staying in really tiny guest houses, or we got lost and we didn't know where we were. The kids got hungry. They didn't like the food, all that, you know, typical kid stuff, honestly.
Yes.
I remember having a moment in New Zealand where it was just like, oh my goodness, you guys just go to bed. It was 10 p.m. and it was still bright out, you know, because it was way south and this is the height of summer. And I just needed to sit out there with some wine and just say, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm with my kids nonstop. And I still have, you know, 7 more months to go. What am I going to do? But looking back, of course, hindsight and 2020 vision, that was really the best part. Like, we bonded in ways that we didn't know was possible. So it was worth it.
Oh, I'm you know what? Yes, I'm sure it is so worth it. And as you look back, you know, it's going to be more worth it as time, you know, passes and stuff. Well, tell me some of the more amazing, outrageous things you did with your family while traveling the world.
You know, we went on safari in Kenya, and that was a really cool experience because it was my oldest daughter's 10th birthday. And so her dad woke her up at 4 in the morning to do a sunrise hot air balloon ride over the Maasai Mara. And that was just incredible. And we even joked with her about, okay, next year, you know, we're like ordering a pizza and watching something on Netflix.
Thank you. I'm thanking you for all the parents out there who know they can never top
I
that.
I know, because it's like, good grief, this is insane. You know, we walked the world's oldest Medina in Fez, Morocco, which is like, you know, an ancient city. We saw Victoria Falls, which is just phenomenal and amazing. We saw all sorts of just great art and architecture and museums in Europe. You know, as I mentioned, New Zealand, which is just incredible. And I mean, honestly, all sorts of big and small places. And what's really interesting for us to take away was that it was the small things that ended up having the most meaning. We, in order to keep this sane, we stopped in 3 places for a lot longer, like 4 to 6 weeks. And we just kind of lived life, and we caught up on homework and work and all that stuff. And that's the moment that we most enjoyed. We talk about those things the most.
And what were those 3 places that you decided to stop a little longer?
The first one was Thailand. And the second one was Australia. And the third was France.
Okay.
And we spread those out over our trip just to catch our breath, and it was worth it. That's what made it doable, actually, for us.
I see. So you had planned before to kind of take a few extra weeks in those cities just to kind of spread it out a little bit.
Right. Yeah. Like, for example, in Australia, we had a house sitting opportunity that was given to us. Friends were leaving town and they said, do you want to? So, you know, it was just in the suburbs of Sydney. It wasn't anywhere terribly flashy and exciting, but we thought, what a great opportunity just to live in a real house, you know, have a kitchen with groceries and just for the kids to catch up on school and they have a backyard to play in. And that just made it all worth it.
Well, let me ask you this. When you do that much traveling, when you're traveling for almost a whole school year, I guess a school year, like you said, do you sometimes miss the sense of community that you have, you know, your friends or community groups? I mean, you said you spent all this time with your family. Was that part of the equation, too, or did you find ways to find community when you were traveling?
Well, you know, that's actually the message or the big takeaway I found out in when I wrote At Home in the World is that I realized the one thing that we missed the whole time was regular ongoing community. And yes, we found great when we made fun friends as we traveled. There's other families that do this and, you know, you meet locals and you have a great time. But that's not the same as real community, which is day in, day out with the same people who get to know you. You get to know them. And that's kind of where I think we're meant to live. And where real life happens. And so for me, the takeaway is I love traveling, but I also love being at home, and both are important. And you can love both, and that doesn't have to be this paradox. You know, you can be a homebody and have wanderlust, and they play nicely together. But I think travel becomes all the more sweeter when you have a home base with community in it.
Let me ask you this question, and this is going to from all the parents out there. You know, just going like for, you know, a week in the car to grandma's house, all the way to traveling for 9 months all over the world with your kids, there's some commonality there on traveling with kids. And I'm going to paint you as an expert about this because you probably learned things on this that you can pass along to other parents, some tips for traveling with your children.
Yeah, you know, I honestly think the more you do it, the better they become. The best way to raise good travelers is just to give them lots of opportunities. So what I tell people though practically is a lot of times people ask, how do you do it? And they tend to have a 1 to 3 year old. And I tell them, honestly, ages 3 and under is really hard to travel. And you're right that it's exhausting. And you're, you know, why you're wondering how we can do this. Something about age 4 and up makes it significantly easier. But I will say that the more you do it and you don't necessarily try to make them not bored, you know, like give them every screen possible, every possible toy. So, you know, do whatever you do, just sit and be happy. Then that actually, you know, strengthens their muscles for creativity and imagination. And it allows them to be more adaptable on the road. So they hardly had any toys for the year. They each got one small thing in their backpack and they did get some screen time, but not very much because it didn't work all the time. And they just managed to make do. Honestly, they worked at it. And before we knew it, you know, it took a few months before we got the rhythm of it. They just became much better at it. So what I tell parents is just keep trying and start off small. You know, if you're wondering, how do you travel around the world? The first thing is say, well, just take some weekend trips, you know, go somewhere local near you, try a big city near you and just rely on public transportation for a day. See what you think and how you guys operate, because you'll get better the more you do it.
Did your 4-year-old by the end of the trip, was she, is it a she? Your 4-year-old? My apologies.
It's a he.
Okay.
It's a boy.
Was he able to pack his own bag at the end of the trip?
Oh, yeah. We packed so many times we all said that we could do it in our sleep, you know, because you're just constantly on the go. And we didn't have much stuff to begin with. His backpack was the size of something you'd take to school. And so, yeah, like he knew how to wake up, just throw everything in there and then just be done. And honestly, that was one of the nice things, not having much stuff. It was really freeing. But yeah, he became a great traveler with that.
Well, you and I had talked before. I want to ask you a little about Turkey, because you and I had talked before. Mm. We both have lived in Izmir, Turkey before. And how long has it been since you've been back to Turkey? How long had it been since you've been there?
Well, we did visit on our travel. So I went in early. We went in early 2015.
Okay. And no, when did you live there? I guess is what I'm asking.
Oh, I see. We moved back in 2010. So okay. We were there, you know, what, 10 years ago.
Okay.
Living there.
The reason I was asking is have you seen some dramatic changes in Turkey in those years?
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know if dramatic is the word, but subtle enough to where you start wondering, how is this place different? And then you realize, oh, that's how. You know, for like when we first lived there, early 2007, technology was still a few years behind the U.S. Mm-hmm. in terms of, like, we were just getting smartphones here. We were just getting flat screen TVs. And now, you know, 5 years later, they are right on par with us, if not even beyond a little bit when it comes to newer technology for, you know, a decent price, but and more accessible to people. And that might not seem like a big deal, just more gadgets, but I think that affects culture at large. You know, I was surprised to see, gosh, there's a lot more people here just staring at their phones like you see in the U.S. and I did not see that when we lived there. So it is an interesting but subtle change.
You know, when I lived there, as I had mentioned before, when we talked a few years ago, my dad was in the Air Force and I lived there like 1968 to 1970. They didn't even have television yet in Turkey.
Okay.
And my parents actually revisited it a few years ago and they were shocked. It had been 40 years. They were shocked mm-hmm. how much it had changed. And I told my mom, it's been 40 years. I mean, that's like comparing 1970 to 1930. But I've never gotten a chance to go back and I've always wanted to go back.
Uh-huh.
But they were just shocked at how urbanized it had become.
Our neighborhood was really urban, you know, even when we lived there, we had two Starbucks in our neighborhood. We had a Gap in our neighborhood.
I can't even fathom a Gap in Turkey.
Isn't that crazy? I know. But it was honestly, creature comforts wise, it was just the same as living in the U.S. We didn't have issues with that beyond a few subtleties. Like, you know, they still love to keep their places really warm. I don't know if that was the same for you, but, you know, we like cooler environments, you know, like in our home. So any Turkish friend that would come over would talk about how freezing it was in our home. And we'd think, really? Oh, my gosh. You know, and we'd go to their house and we'd just be sweating because it was so hot to us. So that's still the same.
Well, it's a fascinating read here, and if you've got some wanderlust and you're a homebody, you can be both. At Home in the World, Reflections on Belonging While Wandering the Globe. Now, as you got done with your trip, you guys didn't go back to Bend, Oregon. You ended up back in Austin.
That's right. Yeah, back where we kind of started from in a way, at least where I was born and raised. So that was a surprise to us. We didn't think that was going to happen, but it all had to do with what I was saying earlier about community. It turned out that's really where our community was. And as beautiful as Oregon is and how much we do love it there, what really makes a home are the people. And that's what we realized. And so we're so happy to be back here.
And if I got to just bring this to a complete circle, I just want to say something about Tish, that you run a blog. And after hearing this interview of someone who brought their kids all around the world, you may not think that this is what your blog is about, but your blog is about the art of living simple.
That's right. Well, honestly, we lived really simply when we traveled, in some ways simpler than when we stay at home, because we just had such few things to keep track of and such little, you know, hindrances to occupy our time that it was really freeing. We absolutely loved it. But yes, I write a site about simple living for sure.
Yeah, is theartofsimple.net.
Right.
You can find it there. And also you can find not only that book, but some of her other books, including Notes from a Blue Bike and also Organized Simplicity. And as always, I always enjoy talking to you, Tish. And thank you so much for the time. What can I just ask as we close this out? What is next for you and your family?
What's next is staying put, honestly, and I'm enjoying not having a lot on the horizon. We live in a fixer-upper in this small town, and so we are working on renovating a 1935 cottage. So the very epitome of staying put for a while.
Oh, my God. I wish you hadn't said that, because we just got done renovating our home. It was built in the 40s, and we actually, as our whole life was on hold as we renovated this home, totally. We hardly traveled at all during that year and a half. So, I know what you're going through. Can't wait.
I'm ready. I'm enjoying it, but I'm also ready for it to be done.
I can't wait to read your next book about this experience. Continued success, Tish. And thank you so much for the time.
Thank you so much.
Once again, you can check out Tish's blog. It's called The Art of Simple at theartofsimple.net. And you can find links to her books. And she's got a podcast there, too. And just a lot of fun, The Art of Simple, from Tish Auctionwriter. All right. So excited to have this next person on our podcast. You know him in a variety of roles, including the ABC series Last Man Standing, Emmy Award-winning actor Hector Elizondo. And Hector, return to television for you.
I was out bird watching and reading like I should, but they seduced me here because it's a darn good show, good story, and also a studio I like to work with, ABC, and it's not far from home, not bad.
I got to pass along some of the roles that people will know you from. Of course, very noted Pretty Woman.
I heard of that.
Tortilla Soup.
Oh, I love that movie.
I love that movie, too. If you could introduce me to Constance Marie, I would be your friend forever.
Oh, well, Well, that's another call.
And another great film, Love in the Time of Cholera.
I love that movie. That's terrific. That was done in Colombia. Oh, boy, Javier Bardem, terrific actor. Terrific
Let me ask
guy.
You a little bit about Hector Elizondo.
Ex-third baseman for Commerce High School in New York and New York City. I didn't have soft hands, but I was dumb enough to be able to get down on my knees on hard hit ground balls. So my face used to block the ball a lot. I should have been a goalie. But I had a strong gun. That's one thing.
There you go.
My dream was to play baseball. Baseball, music, and ladies, not in that order.
You know what? My dream, too, was to play baseball, but like a lot of young men's dreams, you learn sometime in your life that it's only going to take you so far, don't you?
That's right. If you can't hit a curveball, metaphorically and otherwise, forget about it.
your life has been one, you know, that most people would envy, a life in Hollywood as an actor. And with that, you've probably been afforded the opportunity to see all over the world. Am I correct?
Yeah, pretty much. Yep, that's what they tell me.
Where does Hector Elizondo? If there's a spot in the world that you would like to return to, that you've been to, that just has charmed you, where would that be?
San Sebastian, Spain, in the Basque Country.
Now say that again, because I'm going to Google this once we get off the air.
San Sebastian, I mean Saint Sebastian.
Okay.
In the Basque Country, in northern Spain.
And when was the first time you got to visit there?
Oh, let's see, about half a dozen years ago, and I went to the province of Navarra in the town of Elizondo on the border of France.
Mm-hmm.
Elizondo, incidentally, means at the foot of the church. Elizondo is a Basque name.
Oh, really?
Yes, and it's an old Basque name. Eliz means church. Elizondo, so I visited Elizondo, and that was quite an emotional experience. It was lovely people, great cooks. Food is to die for, and the Basques are always being talked about as far as cutting-edge culinary art. So the Basques are hunters, fishermen, cooks, very, very physically strong people. Beautiful mountains, the Pyrenees Mountains, gorgeous place, and very highly independent. Of course, Basque language is a separate language. It's not a dialect of Spanish.
Uh-huh.
It is a separate language group, and no one knows what it is or where they came from. They're a mystery, and they're a sociological and an anthropological mystery, and they never let you forget it. There are not many Basques, only 2.4 or 5 million of them, and Basque is a very, very difficult language, but they were so hospitable, and you just cannot help but gaining weight.
How much you work out. There's a movement also among the Basques to become their own country, to be separate from Spain.
That's a teeny weeny, less than 1%. They have autonomy. They have everything else. They're part of Spain. Of course, they are Spanish also.
Uh-huh.
But they have their schools and all their organizations, and it's all Basque. And the first, now, all the signs are in Basque first. And Basque sounds something like this.
Wow.
What the heck? Why are you talking? And before you know it, you're eating.
Now, we're talking to actor Hector Elizondo, Emmy Award-winning actor. Have you been there more than once?
No, unfortunately, that was one time, but I keep wanting to go back, and I get tripped up by life. That's what happens.
Yeah, I know.
While you're making other plans, man.
Yeah, yeah. You also have traveled to Colombia to...
Yes, Cartagena to do Love in the Time of Cholera.
Yes.
That was quite an experience. First of all, working with Mr. Bardem was a wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Madrileño. He's from Spain. Just a very well-rounded, serious actor. He comes there for the full fight. He comes prepared, and he's engaging, and it just elevates everything. And that's always a good atmosphere to work in. And Colombians couldn't have been nicer. Couldn't have been better. And Cartagena, of course, is a Caribbean area.
Yeah, people don't think of it as a Caribbean area.
Oh yes, it is. That's right on the Caribbean, and they have a particular accent that's quite familiar. It sounds like Cuban and or Puerto Ricans, and that area there. They drop the consonants in about 2 seconds. Wait a minute, that's an Andalusian accent. But when you go up further into Bogota, you hear this other Spanish, this beautiful, beautiful Spanish. Actually, among the Spanish-speaking countries, Colombia is known as having speaking the best Spanish. The Colombians speak beautiful Spanish.
You know, a lot of people don't realize you are so close to islands like Aruba and Bonaire that there's actually ferries from Colombia to those islands.
That's right. It's a world in itself there. It's wonderful places to be. Yeah. Terrific.
People well, Hector Elizondo, we so appreciate your time and letting
us. By the way, I'm not from any of them. I'm from Manhattan, New York City.
Yeah,
born and raised. Right?
We should point that out. Yeah, you are from New York. I got to ask you one last question here. Growing up in New York, you grew up when New York was the center of all baseball.
Yeah, that's right. New York, yes. Well before the bomb. Yes.
Yes. Were your allegiances for the Yankees, the Giants, or the Dodgers?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Really? All three?
Yeah, I wanted to play with either team. As a matter of fact, I was fortunate enough on a high school level to be chosen as one of the kids from my school, one of the three from my school, to go to this general tryout for the New York Giants at the Polo Grounds in 1954, which is when I graduated high school, by the way. And that was the day I realized, whoops, I'm not playing Major League Baseball.
Hey, you got further than I did because I never got that tryout. I remember.
Good Lord, I couldn't. You're kidding me? I saw the best of the high school players from around the country. They were very large, a lot larger than we Manhattan kids. And they could hit the ball very hard, and some of them could hit this thing called a curveball. So this thing that's coming at your head, and you're supposed to stay in the bucket. Get out of here.
Dreams die hard sometimes, don't they, Hector?
I come from your duck.
Dreams die hard sometimes, don't they?
That's right, man. That was at 17. That was like a fish slapping you in the face. Wake up, kid. This ain't it. Make another plan.
Wasn't 54 the year that Willie Nelson made, or Willie Mays made the catch off of Vic Wertz in the World Series?
Oh, yes. Oh, man. And when I stood at home plate there and looked out, this is a bowling alley, remember? I mean, this was a polo field, really, originally. So center field was like 500 feet.
It's forever, yeah.
There's no such ballpark. And right field, you could pop a fly ball at 250.
Yeah.
Right down the air. So
very strange, yeah, very strange dimensions, yeah.
Incredible. It was wrong. At the same time, it was so purely New York.
Yeah.
So, there it is. And incidentally, now people are making catches like Willie Mays' catch every day.
Well, we see him now because we see highlights like we've never seen before.
These guys diving, and also they're such athletes now. I mean, come on. Anyway, these guys stay in shape all year long. In my day, you kidding me? They have to wheel them out to spring training.
Hector Elizondo, we'll watch you on Last Man Standing. And thanks for letting us kind of go off on some tangents there. It's been truly
yes,
a pleasure.
We can. Thank you. Be well. Bye-bye.
Man, two of my favorite topics, travel and baseball. I'll talk it all day long. Hector Elizondo from Last Man Standing, Pretty Woman. You know them from those roles. And also, big thanks to Tish Oxenreiter from the book At Home in the World, Reflections on Belonging While Wandering the Globe. Don't forget, you can go to travelwithhawkeye.net. Click on our blog. I'll have links to everything we talked about on today's show. You can also find our links to our social media. Follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Don't do Snapchat. I did it for a while. I mean, I'm there. You can find me. I never post. All right. On behalf of our entire crew at Travel with Hawkeye, thank you so much for making us part of your podcast experience. Go out, experience the world. Remember, your adventure awaits.